from the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Happy Rosh Hashanah, by the way, to those of you of the Jewish faith. Enjoy. Later tonight, it's the 50th anniversary of the Warren Commission. We'll talk about that. Here's what's happening. The airstrikes against ISIS positions in eastern Syria targeted oil refineries that they control. They've been selling the oil, they've been making money, and they've been buying weapons and paying people. The warplanes targeted 12 locations, and they included warplanes from the United States and the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. U.S. and coalition warplanes pounded ISIS positions in eastern Syria, targeting oil installations being used by the Islamic State terror group to make money. That's how they finance their operations. French President Francois Hollande has strongly condemned the beheading in Algeria of a tourist, Hervé Gourdel, by a jihadist group linked to the Islamic State militants. The president described the killing as a cruel and cowardly act. He said the French airstrikes, which began on ISIS targets in Iraq last week, would continue. Let's check in with the person I admire as one of the top experts, Howard Bloom. Howard, I'm glad we're pounding them.
Well, I'm glad we're pounding them, too. They've been making the latest estimates. Last week when we talked, the estimate was they were making $3 million a day from various operations. Today, that estimate is up to $6 million a day.
Unbelievable.
$2 to $3 million of that money comes from their oil operations. So our approach to them has been very smart, but it's produced some surprises. For example, on Monday night and Tuesday morning, when we had three waves of bombers over three regions of Syria with 4 hours of pounding with Tomahawk missiles, drones, and with our military aircraft, including the debut of the F-22, our most expensive fighter ever. It's a fighter that costs somewhere between $170 million and $338 million, depending on how you're buying it.
Yeah.
We have been hitting, among other things, something you probably never heard of before until Tuesday morning, called the Khorasan Group. The Khorasan Group is an al-Qaeda, it's not a splinter, it's an al-Qaeda division that is specifically planted in Syria in order to recruit the Westerners, the Europeans, and the Americans, who are coming to fight with ISIS. And their task is to use their passports to go back home and wreak as much havoc as possible. And they've been working with some of the world's cleverest designers of explosives. These are people who design non-metallic explosives that can be disguised as cell phones and laptops. And there's even a possibility that they've been soaking fabric, your clothing, in explosive material and wire it, so your clothing will go up. So they are working very, very hard. They know our aircraft protection systems. They know our airports protection systems. They've been looking for the chinks. They've been looking for the little openings they can sneak through. And they're getting cleverer at it all the time. So we hit them, and we hit them hard. And the government's hope is that they hit the founder of the group, because the founder of the group got his start with Osama bin Laden when he was 20 years old.
He may have been killed today, right?
They think that, but they don't know. They can't confirm it. But he is, you know, there are some brilliant people involved here. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the caliph of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, is a brilliant administrator. And the guy who runs the Khorasan Group, or was running the Khorasan Group, if we got him, has spent the ever since 9/11. He's been a good part of that time in Iran, allegedly under house arrest, but I have some doubts about that, because he's been moving large amounts of money from Kuwaiti donors, and he's been moving people from all over the Islamic world. And his specific task at this point has been target the United States, target Europe. And we had information from a driver, from a security driver who was captured, that an attack was imminent. So our task was to surprise the heck out of these people, that we knew anything about them, we knew where they were located, and we could hit them where it counted. We'll see if that surprise element has stopped them in their tracks.
And I've got to ask you, Howard, I mean, these oil refineries that they've been making money, they're in Syria. Why hasn't Assad gone in there to take his oil fields?
Well, there's a theory, and it's been floated quite a bit, that Assad was really, in the beginning, in favor of ISIS, that he was secretly supporting ISIS, that he was staying away from attacking any of their facilities so that he could legitimize himself in the eyes of the West. He's been running the line for the last 3 years that he is our last defense against these jihadist Islamist groups. And ISIS existence helped him prove that. Now, the little toy duck in the tub that he started with has turned into a dinosaur, and it's ready to swallow him. So at this point, God knows why he hasn't attacked. But the fact is, we were afraid until Monday night and Tuesday morning that Assad would erupt when we hit his territory, and that that would bring in Iran, and that would bring in Iran's backer, Russia. And it hasn't happened, because Assad has basically shown approval for what we've been doing, because he now recognizes two things. He now recognizes that ISIS is an existential threat to him. They are a huge threat to him. And in all probability, John Kerry and Obama, no matter what we think of them, have been going behind the scenes and doing an incredibly delicate tap dance to bring in as many allies as possible. But there's one other thing to keep your eye on. Yemen. Yemen fell over the weekend to the jihadists. It fell to a group called the Houthi, and that's a Shiite group. And it's a Shiite group that that Saudi Arabia has tried to tell us for a long time is one of the many proxy armies that's run by Iran. So Saudi Arabia is now flanked on two sides. It's like being pinched by Canada and Mexico at the same time, becoming enemies. And those two sides are Yemen on the one side and Iraq on the other. So there are strange things going on in the Middle East. And in fact, the Kurds, because a lot of this is happening in Kurdish territory, there's another thing to keep your eye on. And that is a Kurdish town on the Syrian-Iraqi border. And that town is under not only heavy attack, but roughly 65 villages around it have been taken by ISIS. And despite all of the ferocity of our strikes over the last 3 days, our airstrikes, that hasn't stopped the ferocity of ISIS in attacking this Kurdish town.
That's so right, they're petrified over there. In that
yes,
town.
But the Turks, if you've seen video from there, you see that from Turkey, you see straight across a clear plain. It would be so easy. It's like a big open field.
Well, you take them all out. Boom.
Yeah, well, but it would also be so easy for ISIS to invade Turkey in a minute and a half. But Turkey is being very nice to the folks in ISIS. They managed to work out a deal to get 49 of their consular hostages freed in the last couple of days.
Interesting.
And there's a quid pro quo there, and they won't tell us what it is.
All right, Howard, I value your input as usual. As the incurable Ebola virus continues to tear through African nations, comparisons have been drawn between the disease's victims and the walking dead of horror movies now. But a new revelation from one of the afflicted regions may add some credence to that. A report from Liberia says two Ebola patients from Nimba County who had died from this disease mysteriously came back to life to residents' disbelief right before their own funerals. How about that? In a moment, Matt Stein joins us. We'll talk about Ebola and what it means to all of us here. Mass shootings have been occurring more frequently in recent years, according to an FBI study, with nearly one incident a month from 2000 to 2013. The study reported 160 incidents during the time, with 486 people killed, 557 wounded. These figures do not include the deaths or injuries of the shooters. As we reported yesterday in Birmingham, Alabama, a recently fired UPS employee shot dead two supervisors at a company facility where he had worked before turning the gun on himself. What makes people do this? Why do they get so depressed they have to kill the bosses who probably had to let them go by orders of above, and then they kill themselves? Let's check in with our resident psychiatrist, Dr. Peter Breggin, author of Medication Madness. Peter, why did they do this?
Well, there's no doubt that drugs continue to be a factor, just one factor. Another thing that recently happened where we have reports of antidepressants is the White House jumper 3 days ago,
yeah,
who got into the White House, and he was on antidepressants. We don't know about Tesney, the UPS shooter. I'd just like to see one of these FBI reports mention something other than copycats,
yeah,
which is what they mentioned in their summary of what they think, you know, is contributing to the problem. I do think a lot of this has to do with psychiatric treatment. And
what about the pressure, though, Peter, of losing your job? You have a family, and you can't take it. You probably don't want to go home and tell your wife, I just got fired, and you lose it.
Well, people do that. They've been doing that for forever. So the question is, why the uptick? We know that people who get completely humiliated and feel they've been done in by other people will strike back and try to hurt people. Going postal goes back a very long time in our history. I think the real question is the FDI report, which you raised, which is that, you know, we've got 16 of these, what they call active shooters, shootings a year now, and it used to be 6, 7 years ago, and it was probably even less than that 14 years ago. I think some of it's copycats, some of it's the press playing it up, some of it's psychiatric drugs. I think it's multi-determined. The guy who got into the White House, for example,
through an open door. The door wasn't locked. Yeah. He just walked right in.
He walked in. Well, in July, this guy was arrested in Virginia, charged with reckless driving and a felony count of eluding police. He had in his possession a sawed-off shotgun, which is, I can tell you, is very illegal in Virginia.
Oh, yeah. He had a machete, had 800 rounds of ammunition. He was ready for something.
That was in his car after. This is months before. And then in August, and he had a map with the White House circled. So one of the questions is, with everybody knowing about this increasing risk, how does somebody like this not get more seriously dealt with long before this? In August, they stopped him walking around the White House fence carrying a hatchet.
Well, and besides that, Peter, all this talk of ISIS and terrorism and things here in videos of the White House that they let go in one of their video propaganda pieces, you would think we would have military all over the place.
Yes, I don't get it. I don't get it.
It doesn't make any sense. Peter, put together some more data for us on some of these people, though. I'm really concerned about the pressures of people when they lose their jobs and, you know, they do what they do. This UPS guy goes and kills his two supervisors and then kills himself. Dr. Peter Bregan. Checking your work email at home or taking a call from the boss at weekends could be damaging to your health, according to experts. A study of 57,000 people found that more than half worked outside their normal hours, a trend given by the ease of accessing work documents on smartphones and computer tablets. The researchers found that those who worked in the evenings and at weekends were more likely to complain of insomnia, headaches, fatigue, anxiety, and stomach problems. Muscular problems, cardiovascular issues, also linked to working outside of normal hours. So if your boss calls you on a weekend, hang up on him. Apple's first update to its recently released iPhone software did not go well. It withdrew the software update following widely reported issues that left some unable to use their phone. And an Idaho woman accused of chewing up the back seat of a police cruiser after being arrested in a pepper spray incident could face up to 5 years in prison if convicted of a felony charge linked to that damage. Ebola, are we prepared? Matt Stein joins us, author of When Technology Fails. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. The Ebola outbreak threatens to become a political crisis that could unravel years of efforts to stabilize West Africa, according to a think tank. They say the worst-hit countries now face widespread chaos and possibly collapse. So far, 2,811 deaths in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. They are predicting that 1.4 million could get infected, and right now the fatality rate appears to be about 70%. Matt Stein, of course, author of When Technology Fails and also When Disaster Strikes. He's with us for a couple hours tonight. We're going to talk about Ebola and preparedness. And Matt, welcome back, first of all.
Oh, thank you, George. It's always such a pleasure to be on the show.
You know, years ago, there was the bird flu scare, the swine flu scare, and, you know, I went on the air and I said, folks, this is not going to be a pandemic. They've talked about 200 cases or 100 cases. Don't worry about it. And, of course, it came, it went. They were gone. What about this Ebola situation, Matt, in your opinion?
Well, in my opinion, this one's a really scary one. It's got the potential. You know, it's growing right now at such a rapid rate. that is growing faster than all the efforts to contain it are growing. So in other words, we're kind of doing too little too late right now.
Yeah.
We're starting to throw a lot of money at it, but if we'd thrown a fraction a couple months ago what we're throwing today, then maybe they could have squashed it. But right now it's in a slum city, a city that has a giant slum called West Point in Monrovia, mm-hmm. in Liberia. It's got about 1.4, 1.5 million people, and there's this huge slum, and it's going crazy in the slum. And the fear is that, you know, there's a 2 to 21 day incubation period, and that it's only natural when you're in an area where people are dying and dropping like flies that you want to get out of there. And the worry is that some of the people leaving there are going to bring Ebola with them to other places, and that's exactly why Ebola has spread. I mean, it started in a few little small villages, and they thought that they had gone in and stamped it out. It looked like they'd taken care of the problem.
And obviously, Matt, Ebola spreads a little bit more than what they've been saying. I mean, originally they said, you know, you have to have, you know, saliva or blood or something from the victim. It doesn't appear to be that.
I don't think it's that obvious that it is spreading in different ways. It appears that most of the people who get it by, you know, the health workers are dropping like flies.
Yeah, but how are they getting it? They're wearing gloves, the masks,
well,
everything?
You know, they're in very poorly equipped third world country where there is, you know, even in the best hospitals there, they didn't have much in the way of isolation suits and disposable gloves, so they're washing and rewashing gloves and washing things in bleach solutions. And the scary thing is that, you know, if it does come to America, then sure, I think we can handle 10 cases great with 21 healthcare workers for every person and isolation units and, you know, great isolation suits. We can handle 100 cases great. I think when we start reaching 1,000 cases,
look out,
then you're going to be running out of isolation units. You're going to be running out of people who've got that special training to know exactly how to care for it. You know, what you saw there in Liberia was you saw very renowned doctors who really knew how to do the right thing dying from Ebola, from their patients. Now, I can't say how careful they were, but they knew how to be careful, and they still died. And you're seeing a very high mortality rate in the hospitals. So I think what you're seeing, you know, when I first heard about this, and my partner is a nurse practitioner, and she was telling me, you know, these people really know what they're doing, and they're getting sick. So I decided, why don't I take a look at some other body fluid-borne diseases that are viral diseases?
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at the stats. So I looked at AIDS, and you say AIDS, well, AIDS has more like a 10-year incubation period, not this 2 to 21 days of Ebola.
Right.
So that makes it a lot slower. Plus, you know with AIDS that it's not that easily transmitted through body fluids. I mean, people have contact with AIDS patients or AIDS victims before they know they have AIDS, and most of them don't get AIDS.
That's right.
And there's about 32 million people in the world with AIDS now, and the epidemic has kind of leveled off, like it's not really growing. So then I thought, okay, well, that doesn't sound too bad. But let's look at something that's a little more infectious than AIDS.
But let me quickly say this too, Matt, that if there were 32 million Ebola cases, this planet would be going crazy right now.
That is correct. It would be going crazy. And let's look at, in a minute, as soon as I talk about the next case, let's talk about what the growth rate is now and what it means to be exponential. But,
okay.
But let's talk about the next one. The next one is viral hepatitis. Now, that's hepatitis B and C primarily. So I thought, okay, you know, viral hepatitis, how many are there? Well, I was astounded. It turns out 1 in 12 people in the world is living with chronic viral hepatitis. That's over 600 million people.
Pamela Anderson is one of them.
Now, that's correct. But 600 million on the planet. Now, think about it. And then I asked my nurse practitioner friend, and I said, well, how many medical workers do you know that have gotten viral hepatitis from their patients? And she said, I don't know of any. I mean, I'm sure it happens, but here in the Western world, like, it just doesn't happen very much. So the fact is that viral hepatitis is probably way, way less transmissive than Ebola. And yet, it's gone around the world now to where 1 in 12 people in the world has it and is living with it chronically, and 600 million people on the planet have it.
Matt, stay with us. We'll talk more about this because I know where you're headed here, this doubling rate of this Ebola, and we'll get into that when we roll right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Matt Stein with us. We're going to also give you some tips on preparedness a little bit later on tonight and take some calls with Matt. So, Matt, you're talking about, of course, 1 in 12 coming down with a form of hepatitis. We're leading up to Ebola, which seems to be growing at a more rapid clip.
Yeah, much more rapid. They're talking, the WHO, that's the World Health Organization, reported at the beginning of the month, it appeared to be doubling in Liberia at a rate of about once every 3 weeks. Then on 9/14, they reported that it doubled. They saw a doubling of cases in a single week in Liberia. And then yesterday or today, they reported, looking at all the data, an overall doubling rate of a month. So let's say that it is roughly 3 weeks. Let's just assume that. If it's a month, then it'll be slightly slower. So what does that mean? If that means that if you started out with 4,000 cases at the beginning of September, which is about what they had, now they're up to something like 6,800 cases, and then you're talking about in 15 months, that's less than a year and a half, if that rate continues unchecked, that would take infect every man, woman, and child on the planet.
Jeez.
If we continued that doubling rate for 15 months. Now, I'm hoping that it's not going to happen, and they're throwing a lot of effort at it, finally. You know, I mean, they could have squashed this a couple months back for a tiny fraction of what they're going to spend now. Chances are it's going to really wipe out much of the third world. And, you know, I mean, there's a 50 to 70%. When you have decent treatment, there's about a 50% fatality rate.
It's 70 right now.
It's 70% is what they're seeing in Africa because it's not like they have decent treatment. I mean, decent treatment means that, you know, you've got an IV staff and you're keeping people hydrated and, you're feeding them, you're giving them nutrition. I mean, in Africa, they're getting none of the above. You know, there's typically about several times as many cases as beds available. There's not a single treatment bed available in Africa. People are leaving and not going to the hospitals because they know that the hospitals are death zones. And who would want to work in a hospital? I mean, this is body fluid transmitted. And what happens with an Ebola victim? They start having diarrhea. They vomit. They're sweating, they're coughing, they're sneezing, you know, all of the above. They're urinating all over themselves, defecating.
And it just takes one tiny little virus to get you, doesn't it?
Yeah. How can you avoid, if you touch and handle a person with Ebola, they're going to be filled with body fluids coming out all orifices and all over their body. So the only way to deal with these effectively is in isolation suits, personal protective equipment, PPEs, and there's a huge lack of it. So I saw an article, and they showed, like, a big field of sticks stuck in the ground and rubber boots and rubber gloves and rubber suits drying in the wind. So these are being washed with Clorox bleach solutions and then reused because they just simply don't have the throw-out stuff. So like I said, in America, I'm sure they're going to deal with it great when there's, 10 cases, no problem. 100 cases, probably no problem. 1,000 cases, I think it's going to stretch things. They're talking like, in America, 25 people to care for one case of Ebola. So if there's 1,000 cases in America, that takes 25,000 health workers to properly care for them. You know, when it reaches 1,000, things are going to be breaking down. Now, I hope and pray to God it never reaches 1,000. Now, there's some good news and bad news. You know, the bad news, of course, is that...
You mean it gets worse?
Well, the bad news is that it's in free fall right now, that they're basically saying it's exponential growth, it's unchecked, that, you know, that our efforts to fight it are growing much slower than the disease is growing. The good news is that they have beat Ebola many times in small communities in Africa. They've never had to beat Ebola in the big cities like they're dealing with now. And so, for instance, there's this one guy, he's like a real hero there, and his name is Dr. Mosaka Fala, and he grew up in the slum, West Point, the giant slum in Monrovia. And he was working, he took 11 years during their, you know, years and years of revolution and civil war to get his degree. And he was working with Doctors Without Borders, and they recognized how good he was, and they gave him, got him a scholarship to come to America, and he got a degree from Harvard and a degree from, you know, some other medical school in America. And now he's back there. And what he's doing is he's going and training people within the slums to make these little groups to go around and recognize and teach people how to beat Ebola. And they've beaten it in villages. The question is, can they beat it in the cities? Because fear and panic and everything. And how in the city can you prevent yourself from touching people when there's a 21-day incubation, two to 21 days?
Can you make a vaccine from the person who beat Ebola?
Well, there are people selling blood and trying to and making black market serums.
Some
people who survived Ebola are selling it on the black market because people are desperate for things. And, you know, the other thing that you can look at and say there's hope for America is you can postulate that Ebola first came out in 1976, and you know that both the Soviet and the American bioweapons programs picked it up right away, and they started studying it in their labs. So they've had nearly 40 years now to work on vaccines, to work on medicines for Ebola. So even though there's officially no known vaccines, there's experimental vaccines, you know that the Soviets and the Americans have been working on this for 40 years.
Oh,
so they've
absolutely
got a 40-year leg up.
Yeah.
So, if you postulate, you know, according to Dr. Ali Khan, who was formerly with the CDC, and now he's in Nebraska Medical Center, and he's the guy who's been in charge of Dr. Richard Sacra, who's an American doctor who was not working with Ebola victims but got Ebola. He was from a renowned Boston Medical Center. He was in Liberia, and he was delivering babies, and he recognized the symptoms in himself that he picked up Ebola from someone. And so he has no idea where he got it from, but delivering babies, you deal with a lot of body fluids, so some woman he was delivering probably, you know, had the Ebola virus. So anyway, Ali Khan from formerly CDC says, it's coming on the planes, but we can deal with it. You know, don't worry, America's got it together and we can deal with it. Now, you know, like I said, we can deal with 10 or 100, 1,000, that makes 25,000 healthcare workers devoted just to Ebola for 1,000 people. I think we're going to start seeing panic and breaking down. What's going to happen in the hospitals when you start seeing some of your coworkers come down with Ebola and bring home and infect their families?
Right, plus, in hospitals, in this country at least, they're treating people for all kinds of things. Heart ailments, surgeries. I mean, what are they going to do, create a separate wing for the Ebola patients?
It's going to be, you know, like I said, a few cases, they've got special isolation units set up right now to deal with it. When we get more than a couple dozen cases, I think it's going to get tough. We get more than 100, it's going to get really tough. And if it gets to the metro areas, it's over 1,000. Now, when the Black Plague ravaged Europe in the Middle Ages, if you didn't leave the cities, you were dead. That's just the way it was.
That was almost a fact of life or a fact of death, right?
Well, it killed half of Europe. Half of Europe died. And basically, the cities became ghost towns. Because if you didn't get out of the city, you're going to leave the city, you know, with your feet above you, or you're going to leave the city walking, one way or the other. You're going to leave dead, or you're going to leave walking.
How did they eradicate it, man?
They basically...
They burn it off, or what happened?
Yeah, the Black Death, they basically just, it got out of the cities, got away from its transmission factors. The transmission factors were the rats. The rats were in the cities, and there was fleas transmitting it. Well, here, it transmits not through rats and fleas, it transmits through body fluids. So,
yeah.
In Africa, I saw this film. I mean, it's quite the impressive New York Times videographer. And he was going around a village, and they were filming these huts, and it looked like frozen in time. I mean, one hut had a pair of blue jeans that were washed, you know, blowing in the wind off the rafters. Other huts, they had the sandals in front of the bed. They had the dishes in the sink and on the table nice and clean. 1 in 10 huts in this village is abandoned now. The families were wiped out. They learned not to touch anything. They won't touch the clothing. They won't touch the buildings. They won't go in. They won't go near it. And they got rid of it. Now it's been over 35 days without a single Ebola case. This is one of the places where Ebola first started out in this outbreak. So it's doable. but it's doable on a small scale. When all of the people can be educated, when everybody knows everybody, and everybody knows enough to know, like, when there's a house that had an Ebola victim, to stay away from everybody there. In a city, how are you going to do that? When you're required to go out for your food, if you don't have food stored, and it's in the city, and you go to Costco, you go to the supermarket, you know, you go to work, you go to PG&E, you go to the schools, the hospitals, all those places. You know, in a small town, the knowledge goes around real quick where Ebola is, and you know where to stay away. How are you going to get that kind of knowledge in a city of a million people? How are you going to know?
It's going to shut down sporting events, everything, won't it?
Everything. Now, another positive thing about the Ebola is China. Look at what China happened with SARS. Now, it's much less easily transmitted, I think. But, you know, SARS is more easily transmitted in many ways than
so.
Ebola, but much less deadly. In other words, it was transmitted through aerosol, so, you know, it's airborne with SARS. But what happened? It broke out in China. And China, you know, is a pretty totalitarian place, and they have a lot of money. And a bunch of really wealthy people donated a whole lot of money and said, we got to solve this because, you know, I don't want to die from SARS. I mean, its fatality rate is way lower than Ebola, but it was still killing a lot of people.
Yes, it was.
And so they had thermal screens in all of the public places, and they'd have guys sitting there looking at thermal imaging. And if they saw somebody's image that was the wrong color on the thermal imaging screen, then, you know, some guards ran over and grabbed that person and brought them to an isolation room right away. And those guards had their masks on and had their isolation stuff on, and those people disappeared into isolation, like, immediately. And they beat it. And it's going to – the thing is that we don't have the technology, we don't have the manpower, we don't have any of that to beat it in Africa.
Why is it so rampant this time? Why is it the worst it's ever been?
Because it appears that it's not transmitting anywhere differently. What happened is the budget for WHO, you know, World Health Organization, got slashed. Since 2008, they've been cutting the budget rapidly. WHO went in to nail this infection when it first broke out, and it looked like they nailed it. But what happened is that people got scared in the villages where it was breaking out, and they left the villages and went to other places. So they had, you know, basically WHO ran through their budget and sent everybody home because it looked like mission accomplished, that they nailed it. But it incubated in other villages where people had gone out. And then it came back, and it came back in a dozen places instead of three places. And then those dozen become 24 places and then 36 places. So what happened is that when it came back in a bunch of places. The budget had been blown through. WHO was screaming and saying, you know, we need help. We're, like, over budget, understaffed, overworked, Doctors Without Borders. The French one is called MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières. You know, they were all overworked and understaffed, and the world did not jump in. So all indications is that this was a giant oops. This is just a giant incompetent bungle where it needed the money and it needed the staff, and the people the world were counting on to resolve this were understaffed and over budget and ran out of money, and they were screaming for help, and the world did not stand up until the numbers were so scary the world finally said, wow, we're really scared now. Problem is, really scared now means it's going to go throughout Africa, it's going to spread throughout much of the third world probably, and then it's going to be an infection factor to keep feeding infection into the first world, and we're going to be dealing with this for a long, long time. So, you know, there's all these future scenarios, and I think the chances are really good the world's going to look extremely different a year from now than it does right now, because it's growing so exponentially and so fast. It's going to take radical treatment, much like China did to beat SARS, and it's going to take treatment like this doctor in Africa was doing in all of the villages. Dr. Mosaka Fala is treating, you know, is training little groups to go around and recognize it and teach people village to village. See, when they sent the military into West Point, it didn't do jack.
No, what could it do?
Well, they cordoned it off. The people were freaking out. Everyone is so poor there. Basically, if you came to the line and the military would say, you know, if you cross this line, we'll shoot you. But then they'd say, but how much money you got? And if you had $10, you got to cross the line. If you didn't have money, well, you had to stay in there. And when you stayed behind that line, there was no food, there was no clean water. You know, it's just hell on earth, and you know, everybody and their brother wanted out of that slum. So, you know, think of that situation. Now that they've stopped cordoning it off and they're sending in, you know, people from within the slums trained for how to isolate it, how to recognize it, how to treat it, you know, they stand a much better chance. But the genie's out of the bottle. You know, it's out of the bottle. It's growing in free fall. It's going to take a huge effort to stop it. And the chances are really good that it's coming to a theater near you.
Yeah,
Ebola is coming to a theater near you.
Why has it taken so long to come to a theater near you?
Well, because people have to get out of Africa. And let's face it, nobody wants to bring Ebola with them. I mean, you want to escape out of the area and not be carrying Ebola. And if anybody has a sense of decency and they come down with symptoms, then they're going to go get themselves checked. The problem in Africa is there's not enough people to check them. There's not enough reserves to check them. I mean, I can understand if you came from Africa to America and you have symptoms that you're going to check yourself in, you're going to get checked, you're going to get isolated, you're going to do the right thing. So I'd say we stand a decent prayer of avoiding it. But I think then the big fear is that it's going to become endemic in Africa. Endemic meaning that Ebola, instead of being isolated places that gets wiped out, it's going to be like malaria. It's just going to be all over Africa.
I was on a plane from Denver to LAX this weekend, and somebody was there wheezing and coughing away, and you would think they had Ebola, Matt. I mean, people, they were freaking out, especially the people that were sitting next to the person.
Well, I would be. You know,
yeah.
It's scary. And then, I mean, this one virus hunter guy was there. And, you know, he was in Ebola with WHO, and he was part of the first wave that thought they'd stamped it out. And then they sent him back. And it turned out that, you know, he was good friends with the sheik that was, like, the most respected medical man in the country in Liberia who died. And then one of his nurses, his top nurses, got it also. And this virus hunter had hugged and kissed the nurse, shortly before she developed Ebola symptoms. So he said for the next 3 weeks, every little ache, every little pain, every little sweat, he was freaking out that he had Ebola. And it turned out he didn't. But you don't really know until you've gone that 21 days whether you got it or not. And it turns out one of the reasons that Ebola went so crazy was that when it first showed up, they didn't have the stuff to test for it. And they tested positive. Some of the people tested positive for cholera that later they found out was Ebola.
And they let them out, right? They were in the public.
Well, they didn't really let them out. They died, but they were touched. And, you know, their body fluids. In other words, they didn't know what these people had, and they were being careful, but not as careful if they'd known they'd had Ebola. And so, you know, certainly cholera is a deadly disease too. And so, you know, they were trying to be careful. But it turns out that a whole bunch of cases, I was just reading like a study that was tracing how it got started. And a lot of this is kind of backtracking science. You know, it's like it's being a detective and looking back, like, where did it get its start? And they found that a bunch of these, quote, mysterious deaths in various towns. Because, see, these were areas that were not known for Ebola.
Hold on, Matt. We're going to come right back. We'll talk more, and we'll also take some phone calls. Lots of folks are interested and really concerned about Ebola. We'll be back.